This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Later on Building Bridges, we go to the November 9th rally in Philadelphia to defend Mumia Abu-Jamal. But first...
That Democrats and the GOP alike ran against the trade policy status quo highlights the intensity of public ire about our job exporting trade policy. A phenomenon also seen in national polls. It also reveals the trouble that the White House and GOP leaders should face if they try to pass the leftover Bush trade pacts with Korea, Colombia, and Panama.
Public Citizens Global Trade Watch just released a report illustrating the House Democrats that ran on fair trade platforms in competitive and open seat races were three times as likely to survive the GOP tidal wave than Democrats who ran against fair trade. We'll discuss the findings of the report, Election 2010, The Best Defense Was a Fair Trade Offense, particularly in light of the G20 summit.
Todd Tucker, Research Director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
This was quite a striking report that you came out with, which is that the electorate somehow understands the issue of trade sufficiently to be across partisan lines, if you will, in opposition to the NAFTAization, if you will, of the various trade policies that have been in effect. Tell us more about the findings of your report and whether I'm characterizing it correctly.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, to just kind of take a step back, I think that if we look at, you know, what are the roles of trade agreements in so-called neoliberal policies or policies that have been pushed by multinational corporations over the last few decades. In the past, we had trade agreements that were basically about lowering tariffs to goods that crossed borders. But today's trade agreements, since NAFTA and also the World Trade Organization, encompass a much wider range of subject matters, including how we regulate the domestic economy, what is the balance of rights between businesses, labor, and regulators. In particular, we see a lot of provisions in these agreements that promote a deregulation of the domestic economy. This is unsurprising since a lot of the corporations that have been pushing these agreements are not just manufacturing and export-oriented firms, but are firms like Citigroup and others that really, rather than being concerned about tariffs, are a lot more concerned about the kind of regulations that they face within countries. So we've seen these pacts like NAFTA, pacts like the WTO, the really sort of hundreds of pages of text that focus a lot more on those kind of matters, and in particular, promoting job offshoring, not just through lowering tariffs and subjecting U.S. workers to competition with low-wage counterparts abroad, but also by giving corporations that are operating in places like Peoria or Buffalo an incentive to relocate their operations abroad and enjoy, under these trade agreements, a wide range of special privileges in domestic economies where they can challenge government regulations related to environment or consumer safety, and they can challenge these measures for cash compensation in tribunals that are set up under the auspices of the trade agreements. And corporations have been very successful under these systems of claiming that kind of cash compensation from taxpayers in Mexico and in other countries as well. So when you sort of look at the so-called trade policy in the broader perspective, you can kind of see both why there are corporations that are pushing it so adamantly, but also why so many citizen groups and labor groups across the country are tuning into this issue and telling both pollsters and at the election booth, telling candidates that they favor fair trade policies.
Well, beginning with NAFTA and with every subsequent trade pact, both parties basically have been saying this will create jobs, and it hasn't. And we see Obama in India and the G20 on the same mantra that this will create jobs. What policies will he be promoting which he will say will create jobs, and will they create jobs?
Well, if we look at the record of the over dozen countries that we have NAFTA-like trade agreements with, and we look at the record of U.S. exports and of creation of jobs, we see that not only do we have a substantial trade deficit with the countries we have trade agreements with, and this includes both the NAFTA countries and other countries as well, that all else equal, that means that we have fewer jobs here in America for U.S. workers. But we've also seen, if you just want to look at not the export minus the import side, but just the export side, we also find that the rate of export growth to these countries we have NAFTA-like agreements with lags substantially behind that to other countries, which again sort of would, all else equal, mean less jobs here in the United States. So it's very frustrating. And if you look even actually, if you mentioned Korea, if you look at even the government's own independent and agency estimates of what the Korea trade deal will likely mean, it will mean an increase also in the U.S. trade deficit. So it's particularly preoccupying, and I think you see the talking points coming out of the White House. They're sort of cherry-picking some of the numbers from the various reports that are out there suggesting that there'll be job creation, when in fact the government's own estimates show that the Korea trade deal will lead to an increase in the U.S. trade deficit.
I want to try to understand better. Let's just maybe for the moment focus on the Korea Free Trade Act. Now, in the context of President Obama, certainly when he was a candidate for office, gave some indication that he would not adopt wholesale the Bush policies relevant to trade, and we might even move into, which we'll discuss in a while, what constitutes, but fair trade. But going to the Korean free trade, what, in your opinion, is the problem with it that highlights the loss of jobs, issues of environmental standards not being observed, and so on?
Sure. Well, I think that the president campaigned and won on a platform of fundamentally reforming these NAFTA-style trade agreements. One of the key things that he highlighted, and that groups like Public Citizen have also highlighted, is this problem of creating a sort of separate judicial system where corporations get to attack environmental laws that might not even be plausible under the domestic judicial systems. And as I said, we see that that's sort of a real incentive to increase job offshoring from places where there are sort of strong judicial systems that might protect, or might, I should say, might balance, strike a balance between sort of the corporate interest and the public interest. If corporations can set up a parallel judicial system to resolve their disputes that is much more pro-corporate and lacks that balance, and moreover lacks any form of democratic accountability or checks and balances between different branches of government that we have in the domestic sphere, that's a major problem. So President Obama campaigned against this system, committed to reform it, but what we see in the agreement with Korea, which was negotiated by George W. Bush and his administration in 2007, is that it contains this very problematic system from NAFTA. So a lot of labor, environmental, and other groups, including many members of Congress as well, have been calling on President Obama to really, you know, if he's going to move forward with the Korea trade agreement, to really put, you know, a quote-unquote Obama brand on it, to put something that really resonates with his campaign commitments and doesn't flip-flop on those campaign commitments. And we'll see sort of where the administration comes down. For the last 2 years, they've been fairly quiet about what exactly they seek to fix in these leftover Bush agreements.
So what exactly do you think should be fixed in these agreements? So we're talking about offshoring jobs. We're talking about labor protections within Korea, we're talking about environmental protections. Could you be a bit more specific?
Sure. The sort of template for what a fair trade agreement would look like has been written and encapsulated in a piece of legislation known as the Trade Act, which was introduced by Senator Sherrod Brown from Ohio, a real friend of labor and of fair traders. And basically that has sort of, you know, an 100-point plan for overhauling these agreements. What people are saying with the Korea deal specifically is that, you know, at a minimum, what we need to do is remove this private investor system, this private investor state system of enforcement of corporate rights, where corporations get to directly challenge governments outside of the national judicial system. We say that that's one of the worst excesses of NAFTA, and that's one of the most important things to fix. And also some of the provisions related to financial services deregulation. Especially after the Wall Street crash and crisis, it really makes no sense to have these rules that were effectively written by banks like Citigroup and companies like AIG. It does not make sense to have provisions that favor those kinds of firms over the public interest in trade agreements.
So at this juncture, I just want to move back for a moment to the report that you did and the findings that, again, across partisan lines, there was an understanding that what amounts to offshoring jobs was something that was negative. So why isn't, and maybe it's not fair to ask you, but politically, I'm going to do it anyway. Why do you think that the Obama administration, since its initial pledges in the campaign to move away from the Bush NAFTAization policies, why do you think they haven't done it if it has this kind of cachet with the public who can understand that it's not about the creation of jobs, but really much more to the point of outsourcing?
Sure. Yeah, well, I think that, you know, there's a few possible explanations, and we'll kind of see where the rubber hits the road. One possible explanation, the sort of hopeful explanation, or the hopeful prediction, is that, in fact, they have been listening to the AFL-CIO, to Change to Win, to other groups that have been advocating for these types of changes to our status quo trade policies, and that they're going to unveil it. You know, I don't know what the probability of that would be. But I think another possibility is that they actually don't intend to change a lot of these provisions. And that's either because they're being politically tone deaf, they're not listening to what voters have said, what voters have been telling pollsters for years now. And, you know, that's at least, if it's just political tone deafness, hopefully that's something that can be changed. And in fact, on our website, citizen.org, We urge folks to get in touch with David Axelrod, who's one of Obama's top political advisors, and advising him that, you know, they need to either be listening to the electorate or they need to seek professional counseling for this sort of seeming political death wish that they have embarked upon by pushing forward on Bush's trade deal. You know, again, there's a little bit of time to change the course of the future, and we do hope that they'll listen to voters, listen to folks that are contacting them hopefully in the coming days, and change course. There still is time.
The Obama regime has made noises as if they're going to change the relationship with regard to trade with China. Is it just noises, or do you think this is real?
I think the administration has taken more steps than previous administrations to simply enforce the laws. Enforce the trade laws that are on the books that require fair trade on the part of China. You know, unfortunately, that is sort of just the minimum that one should be doing, which is just enforcing the laws that are presently on the books. Past administrations did not even do that. So in a sense, it's a step forward. And there's been, you know, any number of challenges both within the World Trade Organization and unilaterally that the Obama administration has pursued against some of the worst aspects of China's unfair trade practices. However, that really should be just kind of the beginning of a more fundamental fair trade overhaul in lines with what President Obama himself campaigned.
Todd, again, going back to 2008, the presidential campaign, and then-candidate Obama had really pledged to chart a new course for American trade policy. If the best is to happen, what should, Ken asked you a little bit about this, but I wanted to flesh it out a bit more. What would be a fair trade agreement and relationship that should be enacted at this juncture?
There's certainly sort of a fundamentally different model that needs to be pursued in future agreements. But at a minimum, in order to gain political support for this Korea trade deal, which was already largely negotiated, and really as a down payment on further reforms in the future, we'd like to see three things from the administration. First, they need to look at the labor chapter of the agreement and ensure that the labor rights that are contemplated in the text of the agreement need to be fully enforceable. We haven't seen that with some other recent trade deals. Two, they need to remove this insane investor state system that allows corporations to privately enforce their rights against foreign governments. We see that as a major cause of job offshoring, and we also see it as a major cause of deregulation. And then finally, they need to commit to remove the financial services deregulation provisions that are in the U.S.-Korea trade deal as it is currently negotiated. If they do those three things, that will be a significant down payment on further reforms in the new trade agreements that the administration may negotiate in the future.
Well, I was very heartened upon reading your report that there are some issues relevant to the core issue, which is people saying the economy, i.e. that there was a repugnance to the outsourcing of jobs. And maybe that does become the common denominator to build a more cohesive movement, and perhaps we'll pay very close attention to the G20, and maybe there will be the rectification of the problems that have heretofore existed in the NAFTA trade agreements. So I want to encourage, just tell us one more time, where can people go to find out the information that is contained in the very important and very readable reports that have been done by Public Citizen?
Please go directly to tradewatch.org. There you can find a number of studies, including on the impact of fair trade on elections and why it makes sense for candidates from both political parties to be running on this issue. And indeed, some of the successful ones have been.
Well, Todd Tucker, Research Director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, thank you for joining us. We'll have to have you back soon to evaluate and analyze what actually does happen.
I hope we'll have some good news.
Indeed. Thank you again.
Okay, bye.
Bit of Cannonball Adderley from his Mercy, Mercy, Mercy album.
On November 9th in Philadelphia, hundreds of supporters of Mumia Abu-Jamal rallied outside a hearing of the Federal Third Circuit Court of Appeals, where his attorneys argued against the reimposition of his death sentence. We go first to the press conference with Mumia's new lead counsel, Judith Ritter, professor of law and director of the Criminal Defense Clinic at Widener University School of Law, Delaware campus. And then to a statement by Professor Johanna Fernandez of Baruch College. She's the producer of a new documentary, Justice on Trial, about Mumia's case.
Free Mumia Abu-Jamal!
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 Wow. With Bob Brick,
wall
by wall.
We gotta
free Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Bob Brick,
wall by wall. We gotta free Mumia Abu-Jamal.
This is all about the misimpression that was given to the jury in the penalty phase of this case about how to consider mitigating evidence. And the jury is supposed to be free to consider a wide range of mitigating evidence. The instructions, the verdict sheet, gave the impression to the jury that that was not the case, that they had to be unanimous. Mills is an older Supreme Court case from the 80s saying that doing that is unconstitutional. This court said 2 years ago that what happened in our penalty phase was a violation of Mills as well. That's it. Spisak was a case last year where the Supreme Court denied Mills relief, but it's a very, very different case, very different facts, and that's why I believe that the law is really strongly on our side. When the jury comes back with a verdict after a penalty phase about whether to whether to find for life or a death sentence, they have a form that they fill out, and the form was misleading. That's essentially what this is about.
Judith, important question. In 2007, the Third Circuit Court of Appeals upheld Mills, and you argued it. Yes. Why did they uphold Mills then, and what is different about what's happened today following Spisak?
Right, it was 2008. They found that there was error here. They found that there was an unconstitutional way of presenting this to the jury. And today, there's really nothing that has changed that should change their minds about that. Nothing. That's it. And, you know, just because the U.S. Supreme Court decided another case based on Mills, the Supreme Court probably for practical reasons said, all right, let's see if the Third Circuit wants to reconsider. No reason to think that they would reconsider, because this is very, very different. And, you know, just that's really, it's a pretty narrow issue, and that's what it is. If it gets a favorable ruling, if the government wants to seek a death sentence, they have to conduct a new penalty phase.
In the courtroom, we saw something that we hadn't seen in a long time. The prosecutor who prosecuted this case originally in 1981, Joe McGill, was in the house. Maureen Faulkner was also present. And the entire political apparatus of Philadelphia was present. This did not happen in 2007. This happened today because the political apparatus of Philadelphia is hell-bent on executing Mumia and winning on Mills, an issue that they lost in 2007. So they really brought out all of their guns today. The state wants to execute Mumia, and we need to tell the Third Circuit Court of Appeals that we are watching. What was disturbing as I sat in the courtroom today is the obsessiveness of the court with seemingly insignificant details. Semantics, exactly. Really, why has no court actually considered the totality of violations in this case, all of which are horrifically fraudulent? I wanted to ask McGill, why was it that the fourth person at the scene of the crime, Kenneth Freeman, who was the killer of Officer Faulkner, why did he conceal that from Mumia's trial when he actually acknowledged it 2 weeks later in Billy Cook's trial? Why? Why isn't the courtroom looking at the photographs of Pedro Polakoff? Pedro Polakoff was the first person at the scene of the crime, and he took photographs. And those photographs demonstrate quite clearly how the police tampered with evidence, misheld the guns, moved the head around. Why? Because the cops and the prosecution had a theory of what happened, and they needed the crime scene to fit their theory of what happened. Why was it that the police didn't conduct the routine paraffin test, right? If they thought Mumia did it, Mumia's hands would have had the dust from the gunpowder residue, right? So they should have conducted a test immediately if they were so certain that Mumia killed Officer Faulkner, but they didn't. This is something that the cops have been doing in the United States since time immemorial. This is not a new technology. This is a routine operation, but they failed to conduct that test. The media and the cops, after December 9th, 1981, on December 10th, reported that a .38 caliber gun killed Officer Faulkner. Well, at trial, you know what the medical examiner determined? Well, no, it wasn't a .38 caliber gun that killed Officer Faulkner. It was a .44 caliber gun. But Mumia had a .38 caliber gun. Somehow, the bullet was lost. Some important fragment of the bullet was later lost. Oh, really? So there are so many inconsistencies in this case. 40% of Philadelphia was African American at that time. Only one or two black jurors made it to the jury. And why is this important? This is important because the African American community has a very different experience with the cops. So when they get to the courtroom, they are not going to believe everything the cops say. That's not what white Americans experience, however, in their communities, in the suburbs. White Americans have a very, very different experience with the cops. So Mumia had the right to have people in his jury that knew firsthand that the cops cheat, that the cops lie, that the cops tamper with evidence in order to obtain a conviction. That's why a jury of your peers is so important in this country, and that's why it's a constitutional violation if you don't have a jury of your peers. So I'd like to ask the media, I'd like to ask the court, I'd like to ask the political apparatus in Philadelphia, why has no court listened to the totality of violations, civil rights and constitutional, in this case?
Brick by brick, wall by wall,
we got free Korea.
We said brick by brick,
thanks to WBAI's Bob Lederer and John Riley for the recording and initial editing of this crucial update on the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.